Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Tonight we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Institute for Philosophy and Religion and the Center for Humanities titled Dehumanization and Its Discontents. Our speaker is Yale University Professor of Psychology and Cognitive Science, Paul Bloom. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Institute for Philosophy and Religion Director David Eckel.
So we're very pleased today to welcome Professor Paul Bloom, who's visiting us from Yale. I'll say a few words about his interests and his background, and then I will turn things over to him. We're all here, and I know very eager to hear what he has to say. Professor Bloom's research explores how children and adults understand the physical and social world. He works in the psychology department at Yale, and he has a special focus on morality, religion, fiction, and art. He's won numerous awards for his research and teaching. He's past president of the Society for Philosophy and Psychology and co-editor of Behavioral and Brain Sciences, one of the major journals in the field. Dr. Bloom has written for scientific journals such as Nature and Science, and for popular outlets such as the New York Times, The Guardian, The New Yorker, The Atlantic Monthly. He is the author or editor of 7 books, including Against Empathy, The Case for Rational Compassion. Please join me in welcoming Professor Paul Bloom to speak to us about dehumanization and its discontents. Thank you.
Thank you, David, for the very gracious introduction. The title's Dehumanization, but strictly speaking, it's going to be a kind of a dehumanization sandwich with two big pieces of empathy on each side surrounding that. So I'll talk a lot about empathy, and then I'll get to dehumanization, and you'll see the context in which it comes into. I started writing about empathy a few years ago, and I wrote something for a popular outlet, and as I was working on this, I was looking forward to the response it would get, and I figured people would like it because it was somewhat critical of empathy, and I figured it would provide a new perspective. And so the day it went out, I went on social media to see what people were saying about it, and this is the first thing that I saw. And so I've come to realize that my ideas don't meet with universal approval and love. And I think there's all sorts of things going on here. Part of the issue is definitional. So people use the word empathy to mean very different things. Some people use it to refer to everything good. Concern, compassion, kindness, love, morality. And I'm not against that. Some people use it to refer to the ability to figure out what's going on in other people's heads. Psychologists call this theory of mind or naive psychology, social intelligence, emotional intelligence, but sometimes cognitive empathy. And I'm not against this either. If you want to make the world a better place, knowing what makes people happy or sad, knowing what they believe, is kind of essential. But on the other hand, if you're a psychopath or a con man or a seducer or a sadist, and you want to make the world a worse place, it also helps to know what's going on in other people's heads. This is a form of intelligence. And like any other form of intelligence, it could be used for right or for wrong. In any case, the sense of empathy that I'm interested in is something nicely spelled out by Adam Smith, my favorite philosopher, in his best book, The Theory of Moral Sentiments. You know him from Wealth of Nations, but this is better. Smith knew this was better. And he didn't use the term empathy. Empathy is a modern coinage, but he described empathy very well. And he described it like this. When we feel empathy for somebody, we place ourselves in a situation and become in some measure the same person with him, and thence form some idea of his sensations, and even feel something which, though weaker in degree, is not altogether unlike them. We put ourselves in other people's shoes. And he gives many examples. Here is one. When we see a stroke aimed and just ready to fall upon a leg or arm of another person, we naturally shrink and draw back our own leg or our arm, and when it does fall, we feel it in some measure and are hurt by it as well as the sufferer. Here's a nice depiction of an empathic reaction. There's a lot of interest in empathy. There's a lot of interest by neuroscientists. So there's now dozens, probably hundreds of studies of the form where they put me in an fMRI machine, scanning my brain, and I watch as someone is mildly harmed. They're poked or they're burned or shocked. And it turns out that when I feel empathy towards them, the same parts of my brain are active, admittedly to a lesser degree, as if I myself were poked or burned or shocked. So in some sense, we seem to literally feel one another's pain when we feel empathy. And this is powerful. And so, like, it has a lot of champions. Dan Batson is probably the foremost empathy scholar. And he coined what he calls the empathy altruism hypothesis, suggesting that if I feel empathy towards you, it makes me more likely to help you, to want to make your life better. Martin Hoffman argues that empathy is the developmental core of morality. As we get older, we have more complicated morality, but empathy is the starting point. Franz De Waal says that we live in an age of empathy, not an age of reason. And taking it from an evolutionary point of view, he says, not just for people, but for non-human primates, empathy is the origin of morality. Finally, Simon Baron Cohen takes the strongest view, very much connecting to the theme of this lecture series for this year, where he argues that evil is nothing more and nothing less than empathy erosion. That is, if your empathy drops, you will become evil. And if you're evil, you must have a deficit in empathy. Now, the people who champion empathy tend to see it like a spotlight. So I look at all of you, and I kind of just see you and whatever. But if I feel empathy for one of you, I'll zoom in, and then your fate will matter. An idea that this sort of focus makes a difference is something pointed out by a lot of people. Joseph Stalin, he didn't really say this, but apocryphally said, a single death is a tragedy, a million deaths is a statistic. Mother Teresa really did say this in a Time magazine interview. If I look at the mass, I will never act. If I look at the one, I will. And there's a lot of research support suggesting that this is right. So some very nice studies from a while ago by Deborah Small and George Lowenstein saw what would make people care about a crisis. And so, you know, in one condition, they give you a lot of data, facts about what's happening, how many people are suffering, what you can do to help. And in this study, they found that people in this condition gave a bit more than a dollar. But in another condition, they didn't give the data. They gave a person with a face and a name and an age, and people gave much more. And this isn't just some sort of laboratory curiosity. How many people here have seen this picture? Yeah, it was all over the place. The refugee child drowned off of a Greek beach. And when that happened, when that came out, it had a real reaction. This is from Paul Slovak and his colleagues, that a sudden spike in donations from various charities, including the Swedish Red Cross. It makes a difference. Now, so what's not to like? Well, even if you're the biggest fan of empathy, you'd have to concede there's a lot of moral judgments that don't seem to involve empathy. So for one thing, we're capable of judging the morality of actions that have diffuse consequences, like somebody cheating on their taxes, or a scientist faking her data, or somebody throwing trash out of a car window. So when you see something like this, there's no specific person you could point to say, oh, that person's in so much pain. But still, we recognize it as wrong because it's the sort of action, when multiplied enough, could cause serious harm to a lot of people. There's even cases where empathy can clash with other moral systems. And in fact, Dan Batson, who's this big empathy champion, is very, very savvy about this. So he gives a study, with a classic study, with a great example. He tells subjects about Sherry Summers. And Sherry Summers is an adorable little girl who has a terrible illness, which is going to kill her. And there's not a thing you can do about it. But she's in terrible pain. And there's something you can do about that. There's a medication that will make her pain go away, let her die in dignity. But it turns out this medication is in short supply. And there's a lineup for it, and it's fairly allocated, but other kids are going to get it before she is. She's not going to get it before she dies. Question, you're a hospital administrator. You have the list in front of you, and you can do whatever you want. Do you move her up the list, knowing full well that some other kid who is up the list gets bumped down? When you ask this, most people say no. They say, you know, it's too bad, but it would be unfair, and so on. Then he has another condition where he just changes two sentences. I forget exactly what they are, but there's something to the effect of, put yourself in her situation. Try to feel what she's feeling. And this causes a massive flip. Now the majority of people want to help her. And Batson says, and I agree, it's a case where empathy is leading you to do the wrong thing. Your sudden arbitrary attraction to her plight, or worrying about her, causes you to overvalue her relative to other kids. And I want to take this stronger. I want to argue that empathy is indeed a spotlight and capable of doing all the good things people say it is. But spotlights have problems. They have a narrow focus, and we often point them in wrong places. And I want to suggest that because of that, empathy is biased, innumerate, concrete, and myopic. Then I'll say other bad things about it. So one way to get the intuitions going is to look at the sort of things that have occupied the attentions of Americans for the last many, many years. So we get very upset if a baby is stuck in a well. Every decade or so, some kid gets himself or herself stuck in a well, and the world stops while a rescue operation takes place. We get very moved when attractive girls are kidnapped, as happened to Natalie Holloway, who was kidnapped while vacation in Aruba and killed. Most of all, particularly recently, mass shootings. This is a picture of what happened in Newtown, not far from where I lived. Mass shootings have profound effects on us. And one thing about giving a talk these days is you could always update your slides. And this is one that was not a school shooting, so I put this in here, to the famous Las Vegas shooting. Have tremendous sway over us. Now, these are all, each and every one of them involve real lives, real people, real significant events. But Paul Slovic asks, why these and not others? And so he points out that when Natalie Holloway was missing, her plight, this is before cable, her plight occupied 13 times more time in network news than all of Africa. Even though there were genocides going on in Africa, mass starvations, all thousands, tens of thousands of children dying. But no focus on that, focus on her. Or take mass shootings. Mass shootings are terrible. But mass shootings, even by the most generous definition, consist of about 1% of U.S. homicides. Meaning that if you had magical powers and could snap your fingers so that there will never be a mass shooting in the United States again, somebody looking at overall homicide statistics will never notice you did it, because that amount is indistinguishable from noise. And so basically empathy has all sorts of limitations. When we rely on empathy, as I think we do in these cases, we miss out on things that matter from a more reflective position. So take number. This is some old work done by Danny Kahneman, who won the Nobel Prize for his line of research. Very simple. This was done, I think, in the 80s. They asked people, this was back when people were very concerned about oil spills and birds getting covered up with oil. Those were simpler times. And so he asked people, how much would you pay to clean off 2,000 birds, wash off their oil, and let them fly away? And on average, people said $80. Okay, maybe it's the number. Maybe that's good. Maybe it's high. Maybe it's low. But $80. In another condition, he asked, how much would you pay to save 20,000 birds? And people said, $78. And basically, he found people didn't care about the numbers. The numbers don't matter. You just sort of respond viscerally. The idea that there is a racial or ethnic bias in empathy is old news. This was a cartoon done to satirize the fact that during the Ebola crisis, there was an enormous amount of attention focused on a very few light-skinned victims of the disease, and very, very little attention at the far, far more numerous dark-skinned victims of the disease. This bias shows up all over the case. So my favorite neuroscience study having to do with empathy these studies always find strong biases. So I'm much more likely to empathize somebody who looks like me, who's my same gender, my same ethnicity, my same nationality, who's somebody who's attractive. Well, like me, but for somebody who's attractive, someone who is not scary, this is my favorite study. They did this in Europe with male soccer fans, which actually just males. And so they hooked somebody up to the machine, and they had their brain scanned while they watched some other guy getting shocks, electric shocks. And half the subjects were told, this guy's a fan of your same soccer team. And when they do that, you get empathy. You get this, it's as if the guy's being shocked himself. Oh, it's horrible. And self-report says, this is horrible. It's very painful to watch. The other half of subjects were simply told, this guy's a fan of a different soccer team. Empathy drops to nothing. Neural empathy drops. Self-reported empathy drops to nothing. And parts of the brain devoted to pleasure start to light up as you watch a person being shocked. Now, these are problems, I think, with any sort of emotional reasoning, this innumeracy, this bias, but empathy is specifically vulnerable. Annie Dillard, she says this somewhat, this was written a while ago, she says, there are 1.2 billion people alive now in China. To get a feel for what this means, simply take yourself and all your singularity, importance, complexity, and love, and multiply by 1.2 billion. See, nothing to it. And these limitations with empathy have led people to say we should be doing things differently. And the best summary of this argument was done by the literary scholar Elaine Scarry. So Elaine Scarry says, what about us? What about the need we have, the moral imperative we have to care about other people in faraway lands, to care about people who don't look like us, who aren't members of our family, and so on? And she says, well, everybody says we should try to love them as much as you love your own children, as much as you love yourself. She says, that's nonsense. Nobody does that. Saints might do that. Mortals don't. And in fact, it's actually entirely the wrong strategy. The key to doing good in people in faraway lands, she argues, isn't by giving to millions of other people an imaginative weight equal to one's own, a staggering mental labor. But rather, the much more efficient strategy is simply erasing for the moment one's own dense array of attributes. So when I figure out what to do about how to allocate resources to people close to me and people far away, the right way isn't to do it to love people far away as much as I love people close to me. Rather, the idea is to sort of say, I'll just treat this as sort of a more abstract political or ethical or moral problem. Something like John Rawls's Veil of Ignorance, or Adam Smith's Impartial Spectator, or Utilitarian Calculus, or a deontological application rules, and just do it that way, without the sort of intense love that treating people equally would demand, and that we aren't equipped to supply. So that's sort of my argument against empathy. Now, I wrote up the book a while ago, and I've got a lot of discussions since, and I've heard many objections, and I want to devote the rest of the talk to sort of responding to objections that may well have occurred to you, like listening to me. So one is, look, it may not be perfect, but it's at least a force for good. Because this is a theology group primarily, I'll tell a Jewish joke. This Jewish grandmother's walking on the beach with her grandson, and a big wave comes and swipes away the kid, and he's gone. And so the grandmother looks at him, oh my God, my boy, God, please help him, please bring him back, I'll do anything, bring him back. And then there's a long pause, and another wave comes and washes the kid ashore, safe and sound. And she looks at him, and she looks up and said, he was wearing a hat. So is that I hardly ever get to give that Jewish joke. Theology is great. Okay. So is that what I'm saying? I'm saying, like, okay, it's not perfect, but it motivates us to do good. So why complain? Well, I think it's more complicated than that. A lot of people have pointed out that charitable and other moral choices driven by empathy have at times led to huge wastes of money and resources. An example is actually welfare to the developing world, and in many cases has made the world worse. And there's all sorts of ways in which this could happen. Well-meaning attempts to feed people who are starving have led to local businesses that survive food collapsing and making things worse off in the long run. A powerful Western demand for orphans has led people to supply orphans that aren't really orphans. Linda Pullman gives an example from warlords to Sierra Leone. She thought to ask them a question they had never been asked before. She said, why do you chop off the limbs of children? Because that's what they did. And the answer was, we do it for you. If we don't give you atrocities, you don't come. And when NGOs come to our small land, we exert a taxes from them, we get money from them and everything, but you don't come unless we give you something. Or take child beggars. So child beggars are ubiquitous in parts of Africa and parts of India. But most people who study this say giving to them is a bad idea. These are not free agents. They're often sort of enslaved by adults. And by giving to them, they just give the stuff, particularly the money you give to them, to these adults. And you support a criminal organization, you make things worse. And the answer isn't to say don't do anything, but the answer is if you care about them, there's much better ways to spend your money, organizations like Oxfam and so on. I was in a radio, and there's a case where your empathy, I think, leads you astray, makes things worse. I was doing a radio show for my previous book in London and BBC, and I was on with a minister. And so we were talking about charity, and I just read about this, and I sort of, well, sometimes charity, and I said this, and the minister was shocked. And she said to me, this is like live radio, and she said to me, that's the worst thing I've ever heard. When I see a child in need, I give to the child, and I help him. And I'm both non-confrontational and slow-witted, so I'd probably just said, I got to think about that. That's interesting. But now that many years have passed, I have a response. And my response is, it depends what you want. If you want to feel good, feel a real rush, definitely give to a child beggar. It really will do the trick. In fact, as Peter Singer points out, if you really want to have a lot of money and you want to get the most pleasure out of it, give to many charities, many different charities. When you give to each one, savor the thought of making a difference to a different group of people, as if there's an amazing buffet and you're taking a little treat from each dish. That's what you should do if you want to get pleasure from your charitable giving. If you actually want to help people, you have to do something different. Now, it gets, I think, worse. Consider atrocities, like lynchings of African Americans, like the Nazi Holocaust. There's all sorts of causes for these atrocities. But one, and this was actually pointed out by Adam Smith, one is empathy. Not empathy for the people you're killing, but empathy for those who are said to be their victims. That when these atrocities are motivated and encouraged, people tell stories about victims, about innocent white women raped by blacks, about innocent German children assaulted by Jewish pedophiles. And in fact, in general, whenever in a democratic country you want to motivate violence towards some group, you tell stories about the atrocities they've done. You employ not just hatred, but sympathy. If you look at anti-immigrant rhetoric today in America, it's actually a whole lot of stories about assault and rape. It's a whole lot of stories about innocent victims, often real stories that make you very sad and are used to catalyze violence against people. Now, if this is true, it should make a strange prediction, perhaps, which is that people who are more empathic should be more aggressive at times. And this is something I studied with Nick Stagnaro, a graduate student at Yale, and my colleague David Rand at Yale. And what we did was we told people about an atrocity. And we had five different studies, but I'll tell you about just one of them. In one of them, we told them about atrocity overseas. American journalists go to another country. In one case, it's Egypt. Another one is Kenya. They are kidnapped. They are tortured. And they are killed. And we give some detail. And then we say, what should the American government do? And we give them a whole continuum, everything from nothing to stopping aid to a full-blown military invasion. And then we give them a standard empathy scale to see how normally empathic they are towards other people. And as we predicted, the higher empathy they are, the more likely they are to propose the most violent actions. We find this true for something like child molesting. You tell a story about a child molester, people who are high empathy are most likely to recommend the highest and most violent punishment. Now, suppose I convince you that empathy for various reasons is a poor guide to foreign policy and politics in general. Still, you might think it's important for certain valuable relationships, like between a therapist and a patient or a doctor or a nurse or something like that. In general, it sort of feels that in fact, like at Yale, they have empathy training as part of at Yale Medical School. Now, you might think I'd be against that, but I'm actually for that. What it means is doctors are trained to be kind, to listen, to spend time with their patients, treat patients with respect, and, you know, what's not to like. But what about real empathy in the sense I'm interested in, feeling other people's pain? Is that a good thing for somebody in the medical profession to have? And I think it's complicated. So there's a lovely book, The Empathy Exams, by Leslie Jameson, where she begins by describing her stint as a model patient, which seems to me like the worst job in the world, but you pretend to be a patient, and then medical students examine you. And then while they're examining you, you kind of judge how well they do in different criteria, including how empathic they are, how much they seem to mirror your pain. And so she did this, and then she was very enthusiastic with the power of empathy. And then something kind of ironic happens, as often happens in life, which is she got sick. She got sick for real. And she went to a string of doctors. And her view changed. So she met doctors who were unempathic and cold, and she didn't like that at all. But she also met doctors who were highly empathic, and they posed their own sorts of problems. She writes, empathy is always perched precariously between gift and invasion. And the doctor she liked the most was actually somebody who didn't feel her pain, didn't seem to suffer along with her, but provided her with other goods that were more distant goods. So she says, I didn't need him to be my mother, even for a day. I only needed him to know what he was doing. His calmness didn't make me feel abandoned. It made me feel secure. I needed to look at him and see the opposite of my fear, not its echo. And I think this is clearest for therapy. So if I see my therapist and I'm anxious and depressed and I'm freaking out and thinking my life is in a shambles, I don't want her to burst into tears and say, oh my God, your life is in a shambles, what shall we do? For one thing, it would mean I'd have two problems, not just one. I'd now worry about her. For another thing, she can't help me, so if she's upset. Moreover, she couldn't be a therapist for much longer if she'd spent every session weeping in empathic distress, which is why they train therapists, when you tell them these things, to look at you and say, so how does that make you feel? And I think the same thing actually is true for parents. So my worst moment as a parent weren't when I was indifferent. It's when I cared too much and I felt my kids suffering too much. My younger kid, okay, fine, Zachary, once didn't do his homework. And I said, I didn't do my homework. He's freaking out. And I said, don't worry, you know, we've got plenty of time till tomorrow. You don't understand it. I was supposed to start it 2 months ago. And so he's freaking out. Then I start to freak out. And none of that's good. You're best as a parent when you love your kid, you understand your kid, but you don't pick up your kid's aversive emotions, particularly fear and anxiety and distress. That actually may have a satisfaction to you, but it makes the world worse and not better. Okay, but aren't people with low empathy terrible? And when you think low empathy, you might think that. You might think some sort of monstrous psychopath. Now, here is the psychopath test. Developed by the Canadian psychologist Hare. If you haven't seen it before, you could look at it and figure out how many traits you have and figure out whether you yourself are a psychopath. Though probably if you are a psychopath, you probably know it by now. And it is true that one of the items on the psychopath test is lack of empathy. And it is true that psychopaths do score low on standard tests of empathy. But I'll tell you three things about that. One thing is, they score low on all sorts of emotional responses. It's a general blunting of emotion, not specific to empathy. Second, people with autism and Asperger syndrome on the spectrum, when given the very same test, also score low. But they're not bad people. They're much more often the victims of cruelty than the perpetrators of it. And third, when you do studies asking which aspects of the psychopath test predict future bad behavior, it turns out it's not lack of empathy. That predicts nothing. What does predict is factors 3 and 4, which basically involve what you'd want to know if you face a psychopath and wanted to know if he would reoffend is what's his history of violence and what's his self-control. Lack of self-control and a history of violence are great predictors for future violence. Now, as psychopaths, what about the rest of us? This is from a big meta-analysis that was done. I hid the title for reasons of suspense. And it looked at every study ever done relating empathy to various forms of aggression, physical aggression, verbal aggression, sexual aggression, looking at the elderly, criminals, college students, children. And this is the finding. There's no relationship at all. If I want to know which one of you is most likely to assault me after the talk, knowing your score on an empathy test would tell me nothing. What would I want to know? Well, actually, the very same two things. I'd want to know if you suffer from a lack of self-control, and I'd also want to know your history of violence. The one question I'd want to ask here is, have you ever assaulted a speaker in the past? That would be. Now, there's a lot of work on low-empathy people. What about high-empathy people? We don't know that much about them, but we're starting to know. This is research done by a graduate student working with me, Matt Jordan, in collaboration with Annette Buffon and her colleagues at UPenn. And what they did was they got access to Facebook. And they got access to 2,800 users and gave them an empathy test. And then got their permission to look at all of their Facebook posts and ask the question, if you're very high empathy, like the top 10%, what do your posts look like? What words you tend to use? We have not, this is in progress, I have no statistics, no scientific results to support. But what I will give you is an impressionistic look at the posts of somebody who is very high empathy. And what I will show you in there, and this is just entirely impressionistic, I admit, is these are what words are they used the most relative to other people? What words are they particularly fond of? And this is overall word usage. And then, if you focus just on their emotion words, it's this. And so we'll return to that in a little bit, but hold that thought as to what this might mean. Okay. Now, you might say, you might wonder, particularly if you saw my title, whether dehumanization is important here. And many people would say, look, empathy is really important because you need it to block dehumanization, and dehumanization is a source of terrible cruelty. And this is, again, the Simon Baron Cohen view, where he writes, treating other people as if they were objects is one of the worst things you could do to another human being. And psychologists and philosophers and most everybody calls this dehumanization. Now, dehumanization comes in different flavors. One thing discussed in detail by David Livingston Smith is thinking about other people as if they lack human traits and as if they're more like animals. And in fact, in a lot of the propaganda through the world, and other groups, other races, are depicted and thought of as non-human, particularly as in terms of noxious creatures like rats or vermin. It's not just depictions. In Europe, in the early 1900s, as well as in Asia, there were human zoos where people from other races, Africans for the Europeans, Koreans for the Japanese, were put in zoos on display along with other animals, really showing that he really did think of them as less than human. Another form of dehumanization is not to necessarily liken someone to an animal, but rather just deny their sort of animacy altogether and treat them as if they're just material objects or numbers. And you can see this in something like Auschwitz, where numbers were tattooed on the prisoner's skins. Psychologists have become interested in dehumanization. The original dehumanization work looked at extremes, the Holocaust, slavery. But psychologists more and more begin to ask, to what extent do we dehumanize others in everyday life, in modern life? And so there's different scales. This is some work by Haslam, asking people, you rate different groups on the extent to which they feel these complicated emotions, both simple feelings like pain, but also more complex emotions like contempt. More recently, Nora Catelli developed a very simple scale where you just rank different groups on their humanity. And these studies purport to find dehumanization everywhere. So here's a quote from Haslam. And the point of this is that all sorts of groups are being dehumanized. Sex offenders, the poor, homeless people, dementia sufferers, women, and patients. So I actually think the evidence in favor of dehumanization is undeniable. There are times through history where people have either implicitly or in practice or very explicitly thought of other human groups as, in fact, less than human. But I think the claim has been seriously overstated. And I think particularly the dehumanization view doesn't explain the cruelties we do to other people. And in fact, the cruelties that we do to other people, and this connects to something that Dave and I were talking about before, captures more of an intimacy between people. Now, I'm not the first to make this claim. Kwame Anthony Appiah says this very nicely. He's talking about genocide. He says, you know, the persecutors may liken the objects of their enmity to cockroaches or germs, but they acknowledge their victims' humanity in the very act of humiliating, stigmatizing, reviling, and torturing them. And he considers cases like show trials, where people are forced to confess their guilt to crimes, even though they're innocent and everybody knows they're innocent, everybody knows the person knows they're innocent. The various humiliations like the Jews scrubbing the streets in Austria, or the dunce caps where academics were forced to wear in the Cultural Revolution. He points out that what goes on there isn't a belief that these people are less than human. It's rather a desire to degrade and humiliate them, which to some extent presupposes their humanity. Or take the rhetoric that gets used. This is the very first page of David Livingston Smith's excellent book. And it begins with how people talk about other groups. So it begins with the words, come on, dogs. And Smith says, look, plainly, we're having one group, in this case, Israelis, thinking of another group in which case Palestinians, as dogs, as subhuman animals. But many people, including the philosopher Kate Mann, points out that's kind of a strange way to think about this. Because like I once had a dog, and I didn't scream at it, dog, because it's a dog. You call people dogs because you don't think they're dogs. And this is one way Kate Mann puts it. This sort of thing is an insult that depends for its humiliating quality on its target's distinctively human desire to be recognized as human beings. If I'm dealing with somebody who's really a child, to shout, "You're a child," well, I'm a child. But if I call one of you a child as an insult, that presupposes you're not a child. You don't wish to be thought of as a child. That's what makes it such a powerful epithet. And I think this motivates us to go back and ask the extent to which people's dehumanization judgments are really reflect a view of people as opposed to a desire to degrade them through comments and through rhetoric. And so one example, and this is actually a project I'm starting to get engaged in, is Nora Catelli and his colleagues did a wonderful study where they got white supremacists to fill out this scale about different groups. They got about 500 white supremacists to do this over the internet. And these are the findings, and I'm going to zoom in so you can see them. This is the rankings people gave. So this is the bottom half of the scale. Republicans who refuse to vote for Trump, Mexicans, black people, Turks, Democrats, Arabs, journalists, Nigerians, feminists, Muslims, and at the lowest of the low in humanity is Hillary Clinton. But I don't believe this for a moment, that they actually thought that Hillary Clinton wasn't quite human. What they thought was, is that she is an immoral person, is a monster, is a terrible, terrible person, but a full moral agent. And in fact, Mann goes on, she has a wonderful book on misogyny, this is her case study, the book Down Girl, to talk about how if I recognize you as human, if I fully appreciate your humanity, there's all of these dangers. In being capable of rationality, agency, autonomy, and judgment, they are also someone who could coerce, manipulate, humiliate, or shame you. In being capable of abstract relational thought and congruent moral emotions, they are capable of thinking ill of you and regarding you contemptuously. In being capable of forming complex desires and intentions, they are capable of harboring malice and plotting against you. And this raises the question, so suppose I recognize your humanity. Why would I want to hurt you? Why would I want to make you suffer? And then there's a couple of main reasons. One is, if I recognize your humanity, I recognize you as a moral agent. If you're a moral agent, you might do things wrong. If you do things wrong, you might deserve punishment. Alan Fiske and Tajay Ray have made the argument a lot of the violence we do to one another is not due to a loss of control. It's not due to not understanding the humanity of another person. It's not even done for material gain. It's done out of a moral imperative to right wrongs. This is the logic behind gang killings, behind honor killings, rape during times of war, torture of prisoners, many homicides, where the person doing this isn't like ashamed knowing that they're doing something wrong, but rather saying, I am doing the right thing. I am doing something immoral. And often I am punishing a bad person. In her wonderful book about concentration camps, Andrea Pitzer notices that there's all sorts of things going on in the camps, some which are very instrumental and means to an end, but some are just simply punitive towards some group. So her main example, which I found very moving, is at the end of World War I, Kurt Eisner, who is Jewish, was a powerful figure in European politics, and he refused to support pressure to get German prisoners out from Allied internment camps in the UK and elsewhere. He said the Allies will take their time, the English, the British will take their time, and we don't need to rush on this. He was assassinated soon afterwards, and there was resentment for this that lasted for a long time, up until Hitler, who cited Eisner, and then said the Jews should learn how it feels to live in concentration camps. So there's punishment, but there's also domination, where hierarchical creatures, and there's a certain... It's very important for us not to be too far down relative to other people. Now, this isn't necessarily a terrible thing. This might motivate us to do good works, to earn respect, to earn admiration, even earn love. But there's an ugly side to our anxieties about being too far on the bottom and the pleasure we get from being on top. I think a lot of what happens in the alt-right and white supremacists isn't a dehumanization of others. It's anxiety that they're being left behind. One scholar of World War II talked about concentration camps and said, look, what might look like the dehumanization of the other is instead a way to exert power over another human. And then there's the recent discussions of sexual assault and sexual harassment. Now, a lot's going on in these cases, but if you look at certain cases and the sort of degradations that people like powerful men make women go through, I think it's a mistaken analysis to say they simply want to have sex and these are things they're trying to do to get sex. I think there's many cases where you look at it and you say, that's the point. The point is to degrade others. The point is to show, look what I can do to you. Look at the power I can wield. And this is something nicely put by Roxane Gay, who writes, there's a sexual component, yes, but mostly it's about someone exerting his or her will over another and deriving pleasure and satisfaction from that exertion. Many people think, then, that cruelty emerges from denying that others possess human qualities, and so empathy has to come to the rescue. But I think I made a case that that's mistaken. Okay, finally, you might say, okay, empathy may have these problems, but if you didn't have empathy, why would you ever care about other people? If I didn't put myself in your shoes, why would I ever care? Why would I ever do anything good? I've always found this a weird argument. I've heard a lot weird. So think about all the good things you do in everyday life. You give to charity. If you saw a drowning child, you'd probably pluck up the drowning child. Now, maybe you do this, say, take this case, you do this because you empathize with the kid. You say, I wonder what it's like to be drowning. That must be terrible. I feel it. The drowning is horrible. Oh, and I imagine what it's like to be the kid's parents hearing that they died. That would be terrible. I think I'm going to rescue the kid. But you don't have to do all that. If I saw a kid drowning, I'd just say, it's wrong to have kids drown. I'd scoop up the kid. We do a lot of things for all sorts of motivations. We do things because of our moral reputation. We do things because we have religious values. We do things because we have secular values. In particular, we do things because we care about other people. And the distinction between compassion and empathy becomes critical here. And this is a distinction that's been made by many places. It's been made, I'm most familiar in how Adam Smith makes the distinction, but I have been informed that Buddhist theologians make the distinction too. And that there's Buddhist texts that distinguish between what you'd call great compassion and sentimental compassion. And great compassion is caring about it, loving other people. And sentimental compassion is empathy, is feeling their pain. And they both could do the job in certain limited cases, but in the long run, it's great compassion that's doing the work. Because sentimental compassion burns you out. It exhausts you. It's narrow and parochial. Now, that's a theological perspective, but there's reasons to believe that empathy and concern, which I'm using synonymously with compassion, really are distinct. So you can make separate scales, which is what we did with Matt Jordan and Dorsa Amir, where you get people to rank how much they feel the pain of other people, how much when they see somebody crying they want to cry, how much when they hear something terrible they feel that pain, versus how much you want to help other people, how much does injustice bother you, how much does it make you happy to improve somebody's life. Now, you give people these scales, and they correlate. They're not independent. Sorry, they aren't fully independent. But you can be high in one and low in the other. So, as a reminder, we did this on the FaceTime sample. I told you we tested empathy. We also tested compassion. This is the emotional life, you've seen this before, of somebody who is in the top 10% of empathy. Now I'm going to show you, and again, I don't have analyses, but actually, you're a theology group, largely. You're not going to get angry at me for not having analyses. I'm going to show you what it looks like, a photograph of what it's like to be high compassion. And to my eyes, at least, there's a difference. The people who really care about other people, at least based on what they write on Facebook, are kind of happy, positive people. And they aren't beset by the anxieties that come with empathy. This distinction between empathy and compassion serves as the basis for a wonderful research project between the neuroscientist Tanya Singer and the Buddhist monk and biologist Matthew Ricard. So what they did was, they did all sorts of fMRI studies and everything like that, but their training studies were most interesting to me. They trained people to feel empathy by getting them to focus on the suffering of others, but they also trained people to feel compassion. There's forms of meditative practice that involve loving other people, but without feeling their pain. And they summarized the results as follows. So compassion, they say, is an other-related emotion, gives rise to positive feelings like love and good health, approach and pro-social motivation. But empathy gives rise to empathic distress, which in turn gives rise to negative feelings, poor health, burnout, withdrawal, and non-social behavior. Finally, along these lines, there's some recent studies suggesting that mindfulness meditation makes you better compared to various control activities you do that take the same amount of time. Mindfulness meditation not only, you know, lowers your blood pressure and makes you happier and clears up your skin and all the other things that people say it does, but it also seems to make you nicer. And this is some work done by David DeSteno and his colleagues at Northeastern. Now, to be honest, nobody knows why. There's different theories as to why. But the theory I'm most fond of, for obvious reasons, is it does its work because it shuts down empathy. It increases compassion, but shuts down the pain of contemplating someone else's suffering. And in fact, DeSteno and his colleagues have this interpretation. They quote a Buddhist theologian as suggesting that meditation training enables practitioners to move quickly from feeling the distress of others, which is empathy, to acting with compassion to alleviate it. Now, at this point, you might be thinking that I'm against empathy. I'm not really. I'm against empathy as a moral guide. I think when it comes to deciding the right thing to do, empathy is too biased and too innumerate to give you the right answers. I also think that when it comes to helping people in the world, empathy often leads to over-involvement, leads to burnout, leads to stress, and again, doesn't cause the right action. On the other hand, empathy has all sorts of good things about it. Most of all, it's an immense source of pleasure. So one of the great things about having kids is you get to experience pleasures that you've experienced 100 times before for the first time all over again through your kids' eyes. You get to experience what it's like to eat ice cream or watch fireworks or see a Hitchcock movie. In general, a lot of the pleasures of sex, sports, of other things, of hanging around with your friends, rest on empathy, on being able to sort of draw in the feelings of other people. And certainly one of our great pleasures is immersing ourselves in imaginary worlds, in books, TV, movies, plays, and so on. And there, for whatever reason, we're wired up so that imagining ourselves in the shoes of another person, even if the other person is not having a good time at it, is just a source of immense delight. And it's very close to, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say so much, this sort of pursuit is a large part of what makes life worth living. I hate terminological debates. If you want to say, as some people do, I insist that empathy means concern, compassion, kindness, and love, then I'm not against empathy. That's great. These are all good things. But whatever you want to call it, I've been focusing here on zooming in on a person, feeling their pain, focusing on them. And I think this has various benefits for pleasure and so on. But I think from a moral point of view, it's a train wreck, and we should do less of it. So I'm against empathy. And I'd like to encourage you to be against empathy, too. Thank you.
Thank you. I really enjoyed the talk. It struck me throughout the talk how you were talking about compassion as being this great alternative to empathy, where you're kind of not feeling the other person's suffering. The literal meaning of the word compassion is suffering with. The way that the word compassion has been used up until probably at least the mid-20th century is exactly what you're criticizing. we can kind of debate about which word to use, and that may be a bit less interesting. But I think that the question that I want to kind of get out of that, possibly in the hope of finding a better term, is I noticed that as well as compassion, you used the term concern. And I would like to hear a bit more about kind of what concern in that sense is, how it differs from empathy, and how it differs from if it differs from compassion, as you've been using that.
Fine, don't call it compassion, call it concern. Don't call it empathy, call it emotional empathy. Get all 17th century on me and call it sympathy, though the modern word means something different. And so I don't care. You know, I got to call it something. But here's the interesting thing, which you got in the end, which is I'm making a distinction here between what I call empathy versus what I'm calling compassion. And in fact, here I adopt the terminology of many people like Tanya Singer, like Nancy Eisenberg, like Steve, I get a list of authority, but people do use the term in different ways. Forget about the words. Is the distinction valid? And I think it is. I think there's a world of difference between you're feeling incredibly anxious. I care about you. You're feeling anxious. Case one, I feel what you're feeling. I feel your anxiety. I put myself in your shoes and I feel your anxiety. That's what I'm calling empathy. Case two, I'm not anxious in the slightest. I am cheerful and positive, and I care about you. I say, dude, you want a glass of water? You okay? It's not a big deal. This is not, you know, you're freaking out or you shouldn't. Calm down. And I'm caring about you. Now, in the real world, sometimes these two get together, but you could separate them. If I'm with a child who's terrified of a barking dog, a little yippy little dog, and he's shrieking with terror, I can say, hey, little guy, and pick him up and kind of calm, and I'm not scared in the slightest. So there's plainly a conceptual distinction. The work of, and I didn't talk about this, but it lights up different parts of the brain. It leads to different parts of training. It's when you put people on scales, you could scale them differently in different predictive powers. So it's the distinction I'm making, not the words.
Fascinating. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much to everybody.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You just heard a lecture by Yale University Professor of Psychology and Cognitive Science, Paul Bloom. Professor Bloom's lecture was titled Dehumanization and Its Discontents and was presented by the Boston University Institute for Philosophy and Religion and the Center for Humanities. Tonight's moderator was Institute for Philosophy and Religion Director David Eckel. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. Also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Matt Lissette. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Jack Lepiars. Thanks for joining us.